Episode 5. Someone told me that poor people stay poor because they're lazy. Well, here's what I think. Well, I think first off is to kind of take a look at why they're poor to begin with. And let's just assume for a moment that it doesn't really matter. Okay. And in the context of this, really want to be focusing on in the United States, where there are a lot of opportunities, a lot of programs for helping poor people to achieve greatness. And I know myself personally, I have a lot of experience growing up very poor, on welfare, not really having a lot. And at this point in my life, I've done decently well for myself. Okay, so coming about this from a very personal standpoint, but also in, hopefully by now you're feeling is kind of a characteristic style where you use logic and reason instead of emotion to kind of just kind of talk through the issue and see if we can't make sense of this. Okay, so I've got somebody and they're poor. Here's what the challenge is. And we talked a little bit before in a previous episode about how people will make decisions based upon their expected outcomes today versus expected outcomes in the future. Now, the challenge is when I'm poor, I don't know what the future will hold. I don't know, in particular, if I have an irregular source of income or if I'm living in a dangerous neighborhood. The feeling of danger, the feeling of being in a chaotic environment communicates to our subconscious mind that we are not in a safe place. And when our brains believe that we're not in a safe place, what will happen, and by the way, this is a decently well-known, well-studied phenomenon, and if you want to read more about how the brain works, I highly recommend a book called Thinking Fast and Slow, which talks about the different processes that go on in your brain. Very fascinating book, and I find it's very enlightening for discussions such as this. Okay, so back to the problem at hand. So I'm in an environment, I'm unsure about the future, and so I don't know if I'm going to make it till tomorrow. I'm not sure if I'm going to make it until next week. But I know I have some money now. And so I can choose to spend the money now, or I can choose to save the money with a potential payoff next week. Anyone who's ever had their lunch money stolen by the lunchroom bully knows sometimes when you're in those kinds of environments, saving money is not going to result in a bigger return later on. So that's the challenge, right? I am more inclined to spend the money that I have today and blow it on something nice that I'll get value out of today than I am to save it and spend it at a later future date. Now, anybody who also has spent any time investing in money knows that if I have some extra cash lying around, it's much better to take it and invest it, as a general rule, with some exceptions, to invest it and allow that money to make you more money, right? Money begets money, and that makes sense. But most of the people who are comfortable enough making those kinds of investments come from a spot where they have education and training on how to invest properly. They have enough time in their schedule and their lives to dedicate to such training. And they have enough money that they can invest and are living in a safe environment where they are looking to the future. Many of the people who are investing in their 401ks and their Roth IRAs, they're looking to save for their retirement. They're looking for what happens when they stop working. When somebody is working long, long hours and they are concerned about the food that's available for them, every meal being a concern, it's going to be less available time to think about the future of things and weighing in future outcomes. Okay? That's really what it almost all of this boils down to. There's less time available to study, less time available to relax, right? And that relaxation is very important, right? We talked in a previous episode about ego depletion and how if I have expended all of my willpower for the day, I have very little left over for personal development. The more I'm having to work, the more I'm having to reach those basic subsistence levels, the less I have time to invest in my future. And that's, it's simply a matter of a risk calculus. Is it money today worth more than money tomorrow? And for many finance majors, we'll have a easy time understanding that because many businesses operate in that exact same way, right? I'd rather have money today than money tomorrow. It's worth more to me today than it is tomorrow. The only downside is they're investing in their happiness instead of investing in the market, okay? So now I'm caught in this trap, right? Because I am so concerned about what's happening today, I don't have enough money to invest and make money in the future. Okay, so this is one aspect. I don't want to belabor at this point. Okay, so the other aspect is, and I also kind of talked about this before, is the relationship of IQ and emotional quotient. Now, in order to make it past the starting gates in any particular job, I have to have a certain level of IQ to meet the minimum standards required for that job. Now, here's the interesting thing. I've actually done studies with rats where they've got two rats and they're genetically identical. You can do this via DNA manipulation. You just have mice and rats for studies. They are identical from a DNA standpoint. I've got one set in one cage, one set in another cage, and the set in cage A, they've got a bowl with food and they got a bowl with water, and that's it. And the rats in cage B, they've got the same stuff, food and water, but they also have rat wheels, they've got tunnels, they've got ladders, and they've got little ropes that they can climb on, and all these other kinds of things, right? And that's the environment that they live in from birth. And what the researchers found was that the rats that were in the toy-rich environment, the stimulus-rich environment, were able to navigate unfamiliar mazes significantly faster than the ones who are raised in a very Spartan environment. And they interpret that to mean that if you are in an environment that is a lot more intellectually stimulating, then your IQ will actually go up. Your ability to process information will go up. And this actually aligns with other things where they've, other studies where they've observed people who have grown up in environments in very rural areas without a whole lot of interaction with different societies and cultures, not a lot of TV and movies and exposure to outside stimuli, have a harder time identifying and assessing newer things and conceptualizing abstract concepts. And really what this all boils down to is people who are growing up in a poor environment oftentimes have, in addition to a brain that's hardwired to put a stimulus on today, are also in an environment where they have a disadvantage from an IQ standpoint because the environment has not given them the stimulus that they would have gotten had they come from a wealthier background. Okay, and this can be significant. You know, the hypothesis of, say, 5 IQ points, which can make a big difference. And one of the other things, too, when I'm growing up in a poor neighborhood, you look at the availability of role models. You look at the availability of other people who have achieved success and how well they are willing to share their knowledge with you. Throughout history, we've always looked at apprenticeships. And with an apprenticeship is, you know, someone who's more senior is able to identify a young up-and-comer takes them under their wing, teaches them some stuff, and helps them along. Now, when you start talking about very successful people, oftentimes that relationship will start in college, which, by the way, is expensive. Okay, but sometimes it starts in high school. I mean, the high school I went to was not a super good one, but there is another high school down the road that came from a lot more wealthy parents. There were rocket scientists, there were doctors, there were all those folks. The tax base was higher. And more likely that one of your friends would have a parent who is a very successful person, or your own parent would be very successful who could give you life lessons on how to yourself become more successful, right? This education and training needs to start early. We cannot necessarily rely on the public school system for teaching our children about how to be super successful. And why? Because in poor environments, the tax base is lower, the schools have less money, and are therefore able to pay less for their teachers. And because they can pay less, that means that the teachers with the higher qualifications are going to be going to the schools that are able to pay more, and leaving the ones with lower qualifications left to find any job that's available. So, do you think the cream of the crop are going to inner city schools? Not necessarily. Now, there is an altruistic aspect here where you can expect some dangerous minds style, really good teachers to go into inner city schools or to lower income schools and try to make contact with the students there. But as a general rule, in free market economies, people will go where the pay is best. So now I've got a limitation on the quality of schools, the quality of teachers, the availability of resources, a limitation on the environment. I've got a dangerous environment stimulating me to weigh the present more than the future, not looking to the future as much. I've got a lack of good role models available to that community and good mentors. And we haven't even started talking about crime. We haven't started talking about drugs. And the interesting thing about poverty is that it's horrible. And maybe interesting is the wrong word, but I think until you can get to the point where you're trying to count pennies to be able to afford buying a packet of spaghetti, you don't understand what that level of fear is and not having enough to provide for food. I'm happy that I haven't needed to be in a place I've had to experience that. But there's a lot of mental effort that's expended on that fear, and that worry and that anxiety. And that can overcome you, right? I remember my mother, who worked in cash, so she would do, she was a painter, and so she would do a job and get paid in cash, and she was talking to somebody that she knew, and the person reached in the window, she was in the car, reached in the window, grabbed her purse, which had all the cash for the job, and then just ran away. So that's the type of thing that you got to deal with. Right now, my mother had to deal with, she just lost the rent money for that month, a job that had taken 2 weeks. And the person is meanwhile off doing drugs, which is what happened. And when people live in poverty and that worry and that anxiety overcomes them, and the first time that they use drugs and they realize that the drugs are helping to numb some of that anxiety. And it's not really a secret, as many doctors understand that opiates help to relieve anxiety, relieve pain. That's why they get prescribed, and that's why we have an opiate issue in this country. So it shouldn't really be a surprise that drugs would be an issue. And understanding that in instances where I've got a lack of education, lack of infrastructure, it becomes much easier for turning to sale of drugs as an easy way to earn some cash, try to claw your way out. And that process has been going on since the dawn of time. My mother used to call it crabs in a bucket. If you take a bunch of crabs and you put them in a bucket, if the crabs would just stack themselves up, they could climb on top of each other one by one and climb their way out of the bucket. But what ends up happening is one crab starts to climb up and the other crabs kind of pull them down. Now the thing is that implies some crabs are just going to stay in the bucket, the other ones are going to climb on top of them to get out. And no one wants to be the crab at the bottom. So let's just take everyone else out. If I'm going down, you're going down with me. And there's a lot of that. And there's a lot of hate and disrespect for people who are trying to do well for them, or people who are trying to get grades that are too good or are too aspirational, because other people didn't have that opportunity. Okay, so there's that emotional aspect to it too. It's simply not that easy. And I'd say for colleges, right? A lot of people look at colleges and say, hey, well, we have all this financial aid that's available, and we've got scholarships, and we've got need-based, we've got FAFSA, we've got all these different ways that you can pay for school. We got state schools that are relatively low cost. But we're talking about a group of people who are grown up poor, that have lacked mentorship. And anybody who's been to college needs to think back at the one or two people that convinced them that they need to go to college. And typically it's not a whole bunch of folks. It's maybe some parents, it's maybe a guidance counselor. But if your parents never went to college and none of your friends' parents went to college, and your teachers are not the cream of the crop, and your school does not have an effective guidance counselor, how are you going to know that going to college is what is expected of you? And how are you going to know that you should even seek out those opportunities? And that the amount of money is there if you apply for it. And I say, so my grandfather was actually fairly successful. My mother was not. My grandfather was very successful. And when I got to the point where I was approaching senior year in high school, and I talked to my grandfather, and he said, go to college. Go talk to people and get yourself some scholarships, and we'll find a way to pay for it, right? And it was a mentorship type of agreement, a discussion, and we ended up figuring it out. But the first piece of it was is adding that confidence in me that it was worthwhile to seek higher education. And he had gone to higher education, and so I had a role model. I had someone to look up to who had been there, done that, and I could easily foresee wanting to fill his shoes. Okay, breaking from that tradition, being the first of your family to do something, to move away from home, to go someplace, when your family is otherwise relying on you to be able to help provide for them financially, and instead of doing that, now you're away adding significant amounts of debt. That's scary. And it's even more scary when you're doing it by yourself with no one to help you trail and blaze that path. Okay? So I want you to think about that. Think about what that kind of an environment looks like. And understand that even though a lot of these programs exist, if people don't know that they exist, or if they don't trust those programs, that's a challenge. I think that there's a lot of issues in many of the poorer neighborhoods, and that there isn't a lot of trust with the federal government. I think there's a lot of acceptance of certain assistance, but at the end of the day, when you start talking about particular police or IRS or other types of agencies, there's a concern there that they do not represent the people that are living in those neighborhoods. And because the government doesn't represent the people, oftentimes that can translate over into institutions that are endorsed by the government are not institutions that you want to be a part of. And when you look at a lot of the universities that exist around the world and around the United States, a lot of those are part of that same society. That same society that builds up the United States, the same society that those lower income neighborhoods have rejected. So that's a challenge. I think poverty is complex. It's added complexity due to the physical makeup of our brain, of our minds, the environmental factors that help keep us down, the cultural factors that keep us on a trajectory that's very difficult to break out of, the emotional factors that have people that you know and love keeping you back out of jealousy, fear, or hate, the governmental or societal factors that make you feel that just because you're poor, you don't belong in a greater society. These are complex issues. And at the end of the day, people do break free. It's hard, but it is doable. And when people break free, it's helpful for the rest of us to appreciate how hard that was. And understanding that for many of them, once they break free of that environment, they are beginning that journey. And I will tell you, for me, it took 5 to 10 years before I was able to fully assimilate inside of the greater society, to be able to learn lessons that many people learned as children about what successful people do, how successful people behave, what does a normal adult relationship look like. These are challenges. I didn't have a father growing up. I didn't know what a normal, quote unquote, normal family looked like. And in my own family, it's taken some time to figure that out for myself. It's challenging when you don't have role models and a precedent. And so I suppose the challenge then to you, dear listener, is to take interactions with people who come from those kinds of environments with a grain of salt, give them the benefit of the doubt. If they fall, give them opportunity to pick themselves back up again. Because that learning is difficult as an adult. You're overcoming a significant disadvantage from a difficult childhood. So what do I think? I think there are opportunities for people living in poverty, but there's a lot more complexity than you might otherwise think. A little bit of grace would go a long way. A little bit of understanding would go further. So what do you think? I'd love to continue the conversation or hear your thoughts on new topics. If you have something, please drop me a line. My email is thinkinghardisnewknowledge@gmail.com. I look forward to hearing from you.